hot seat. What are those people thinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
What have those boys been drinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away, so I know what can happen when the nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we revisit my interview with Dr. Lloyd C. Williams, an organizational psychologist who specializes in working with Fortune 100-level companies as a management and organization consultant and coach. Dr. Williams coined the term organizational psychosis and explains what it is and how it applies to Japan, Japan's nuclear decisions, TEPCO, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the entire nuclear industry. He also provides us with some keys for what it will take for our movement to turn around these psychologically damaged nuclear industry individuals and entities. We will also get our fourth lesson in social media super tricks, weekly quick tips on how to get the most out of your anti-nuclear online presence. This with the irrepressible Dave Parrish of Operation Save the Earth. And there will be a serious update on the website problems which have been plaguing nuclearhotseat.com. Plus, in a much more fun vein, our regular numbnuts of the week, activist shout-out, and more nuclear information than Fox Faux News, put that in quotes, has ever put on the air. Ever. All of that will be coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 11, 2015, and here is the week's anti-nuclear news. Word from the Pacific Ocean continues to be devastatingly bad. 18 whale deaths in Alaska alone. Dead and starving baby seals, dead walruses, birds including bald eagles, eagles found with deformed beaks, and more than a quarter million sockeye salmon returning from the ocean to spawn are either dead or dying in the Columbia River. Nuclear Hot Seat listener Stephen Von Wagener turned into a special correspondent, didn't know it at the time, but he did, when he sent me the following letter. I have recently returned from an extensive trip up the California and Washington coasts. On that trip, I visited every marine rescue station, sports fishing facilities, aquarium, and marine research center that I could locate. What I found was in no way encouraging. The marine rescue stations are staffed primarily by volunteers, and they are overwhelmed. Of the three stations I was able to find, all had more than 200 large mammals, meaning sea lions, under their care, with more arriving all the time. The volunteers will not be able to cope much longer, and I don't know what the state of California is planning. Marine researchers at the Monterey and Seattle aquariums are very concerned with current ocean conditions. Seattle's Puget Sound is currently dealing with a jellyfish bloom, the likes of which have never been seen. Domoic acid generated by stressed phytoplankton has been a big problem for Monterey Bay, so much so that the Monterey Bay Research Center recently warned the Monterey Bay Yacht Club to avoid eating Monterey Bay fish. But no such warning was issued for the general public, as apparently they are on their own. Heat, domoic acid, virus, and bacterial infections are blamed for the current carnage, but nowhere is the word radiation to be found as a possible cause of these problems. I get so tired of reputable scientists expressing their shock, bewilderment, and confusion as to what is really happening. How can you call it science when you rule out any nuclear hypothesis whatsoever? The blind spot would be funny if it were not so tragic. In the nuclear hot seat duck and cover report, the Salem 2 nuclear reactor in New Jersey was taken offline on August 6th due to an electrical problem with one of its cooling pumps. And Dominion Virginia Power is projecting that the capital cost of a third nuclear reactor at its North Anna facility, the facility that was shaken by the powerful earthquake 4 years ago, will total over $19 billion, and that's before the traditional nuclear cost overruns and production delays are factored in. Moving on to
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
The White House has given final approval for dramatically raising permissible radioactive levels in drinking water and soil following radiological incidents, such as a nuclear power plant accident or a dirty bomb. That's right, everybody knows radiation hurts you less if it's an emergency. The adrenaline must counteract it. Not. The nuclear industry is touting this as a big win for what they're calling the new normal, and what looks to the rest of us like it's just going through the looking glass into bizarro world. This new Protective Action Guide, or PAG, is the brainchild of Gina Never Met a Nuke I Didn't Like and Cover the Ass of McCarthy, the Assistant Administrator for Air and Radiation, whose nomination to serve as EPA Administrator, oh my gosh, is taken up this week by the Senate, and I hope they drop it just as fast. According to Jeff Rush, Executive Director for PEER, which stands for Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, the EPA package lacks cogent rationale, is largely impenetrable, and hinges on a series of euphemistic weasel words. In short, he said, "This is a public health policy only Dr. Strangelove could embrace." Dr. Strangelove and Gina McCarthy. And you, Gina, along with your EPA, are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
Over to Japan, where Sakuto Hantai means no restart. And that's what people in the thousands outside of the Sendai nuclear power plant and Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's residence in Tokyo have been protesting. And yet, this morning, August 11th, marks the first restart of a nuclear reactor in Japan since the 2011 Fukushima disaster began. In a tone-deaf, brain-dead attempt to reassure the public, Prime Minister Abe said, "I would like Kyushu Electric to put safety first and take utmost precautions for the restart." What, like they were planning something else? Experts have warned that reactors left idle for years tend to experience quote-unquote teething problems, and that such a mass restart of dormant reactors has never been attempted before. A total of 25 nuclear reactors in Japan have applied to be restarted, but all are facing legal challenges from concerned locals. Of particular concern at the Sendai facility is that it is surrounded by a group of five calderas, and Sakurajima, one of Japan's most active volcanoes, is just 50 kilometers, about 36 miles away. Sakuto Hantai, indeed. In the continuing food fight over the safety of Japanese food, Chinese authorities seized more than 881 pounds of baby milk formula that had been imported from Japan because it had been produced in areas known to be heavily contaminated with radioactive material emitted by the three damaged nuclear reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi complex. The seizure came just 1 month after Japan had asked the Chinese to ease restrictions on Japanese food imports. Don't hold your breath. In Ukraine, the Chernobyl exclusion zone is on fire again, with three new wildfires registered. Experts warn that radioactive nuclides absorbed by the foliage around Chernobyl from the soil contaminated as a result of the 1986 disaster can easily be released into the air and have cumulative negative effect on the health of those who breathe in the smoke particles. In Germany, 100% of the Russian guests from Nozyobikov, who arrived last week in Horburg-Wir, Germany, are contaminated with radioactive cesium-137. This according to the Belrad Institute for Radiological Protection, which measured the body counts of all these children. 83% of the children who live within 200 kilometers of Chernobyl and were not even born in 1986 at the time of the reactor explosion are contaminated above the proven health risk threshold of 20 becquerels of cesium per kilogram of body weight. And Vietnam has signed up for its first nuclear power plant with Russia, which will supply the reactors, the construction, the training, and 85% of this first plant's financing. Considering nuclear reactors don't do well with aftermarket parts, meaning you can't get replacement parts from any place except whoever you bought them from, this is just the latest iteration of the Cold War in slow motion on the ground. We'll have our featured interview and social media super tricks in just a moment. But first, well, it's official. We can use the H word. Nuclear Hot Seat was hacked again. Despite all of the security that has been placed on the site, something happened. And we're now in the second week of the site being down. That includes the email addresses I use, so I cannot even imagine what communications from you I am not receiving. Now, we do have an emergency landing page up. It explains very briefly what's been going on, as it provides a link to downloadable recordings of last week's and this week's episode, and it also provides a secure link to PayPal for donations, and we really need those donations. Because this is a matter of not doing just a patch job, but getting the entire Nuclear Hot Seat site up and running and secure and in lockdown, they can't get to us again mode. The database is saved. That's the good news. So we are going to be able to reload it, but we haven't been able to load it back up yet. And no, I'm not trying to do this by myself. I have a friend who very graciously and generously is helping me navigate the gibberish spoken by the hosting provider's tech support. Full disclosure, I don't speak geek. But even my friend's abilities are limited, and this work is ultimately beyond him. So I need to hire a pro to get the work done. That means that now is a perfect time to donate to Nuclear Hot Seat. Any amount is welcomed and appreciated because every donation, no matter the size, I take as a sign of your caring about the show, and it helps keep me and it going. For those of you who do donate $100 or more, my gift to you will be a half-hour one-on-one conversation, just you, me, and Skype, on any aspect of the nuclear issue, or if there's another topic you would like to discuss. Sexual abuse recovery, musical theater writing, Bernie Sanders. I'll talk about that too. If you want, you can put this on speakerphone and have friends around, and we can even record it if you want to share it further. It's what I can offer in exchange for your assistance at this time when I really need it. It's not easy for me to ask, but I've got to, because it's the future of the show that is at stake here. So please, don't wait. We need the help now. Go to the website, nuclearhotseat.com, where on the first screen of the emergency page, you will see a donate link that connects you by secure connection to PayPal. If you prefer not to donate online, you can email me for an address where to snail mail your donation. And the email address for that would be libby@libbyhalevi.com. That's libbe@libbyhalevi.com. Those of you who have already helped, and you know who you are, I am deeply appreciative, as well as touched by your email messages and notes. For those of you who have not yet helped and wish to do so, please, whatever you can do is going to be appreciated as well, from the bottom, top, and all directions of my heart. Thank you. Dr. Lloyd C. Williams is an organizational psychologist, coach, and management consultant to Fortune 100 level companies. Dr. Williams has led programs as chair and professor at UC Berkeley, University of Notre Dame, University of Massachusetts, Grenoble Business School, the International School of Management, and the University of Singapore. He has an international reputation for reorganizing governments, agencies, and places like the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Williams coined the term organizational psychosis, and considering how often we see crazy behaviors by governments and corporations involved with nuclear, what he has to say goes a long way towards explaining in clinical terms not only what the problem that we face is, but how we as a movement might strategize to turn this nuclear stance around. Dr. Williams, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much.
First of all, give us a general sense of what you do for organizations.
I work in a variety of different arenas. One is in the area of leadership development and leadership coaching. Another is in the area of change management, change development processes, and how those work effectively with different types of persons. Multicultural and multinational issues and program development issues for organizations. And then, I guess basically looking at maintaining the social, emotional, and effective health of the organization through addressing issues such as depression, anxiety, fears, trepidations, psychosis, those types of things.
You coined the term organizational psychosis. What does that mean?
Organizational psychosis is the creation of a set of norms and actions that craft structures within the organization that are unable to distinguish the rational process of change and development from the irrational structures of power, control, disempowerment, and dysfunction. It is the development of dysfunction based on a set of prescribed strategies that increase the potential for control through the devaluing and the creation of personal mistrust and personal self-esteem, thereby creating a dependence on the organizational leader and the structure to validate the needs of everything. So effectually what happens is organizations go down a path of doing the same things over and over again, assuming that they'll get a different outcome.
Which, of course, is the definition of insanity.
Which is the definition of insanity.
What puts an organization, be it a government, a corporation, an agency, what puts it on the road to organizational psychosis?
The common answer would be arrogance. The real answer would be a belief that they have all the information they need to make informed decisions, and they don't. And so they start going down a path of making a decision and being unwilling to say, I was wrong. And so they keep piling on things for that decision, and it begins to create a sense of irrationality, and that irrationality becomes very, very difficult for anyone to address. And because the individual who makes that decision has the power, control, and authority, persons become fearful to say, I think you're wrong, I think we need to go down a different path, because the leader is in charge.
So how does that apply to a culture such as Japan, which seems to be one of compliance and not rocking the boat and going along with whatever is in front of them without challenge?
Well, I think that's a fairly clear description of what occurs. If you come from a xenophobic culture that says that everyone must think, act, feel, do the same, then it's very hard for anyone within that culture to bring up a concern that perhaps we might be going down a wrong path. Perhaps we might be making a poor decision. Perhaps we might be doing things that will harm people. Perhaps we're doing things that might cause a rethinking, revaluing of what we do in the culture to do something different. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
It does. Could you talk a little bit more about how this disconnect... I mean, it seems that there's something incongruent about being in a culture where something is known to be right, but the actions are wrong, such as what's been happening since the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster happened.
Let's see if I can say it a little differently. Japan, in fact, most of Asia, operates from a very communal value set. And the communal value set says that what is best for the community, what is best for the culture, what is best for the group, is more important, more valuable than what happens for an individual. So that's the first thing. And to try and address that differently makes you an outlier, makes you an outcast, puts you on the outside of everyone else. If you are Japanese and you do that process of becoming the one who's the outcast, the outlier, you may not only experience isolation and separation from the organization of the corporation, but you may experience it also from your family, from your culture, and everything else. So you're out there all by yourself. Now, in the Western world, that is a process of individuation. And that individuation allows persons to discover who they themselves are and what it means they might need to do. In an Eastern philosophical stance, that's much more difficult because the process of individuation is not something that is valued. What is valued more is communalism. So for someone in Japan to say, I think we're going down the wrong path relative to the development of a nuclear reactor or the development of our nuclear policy and so forth, and you come from a culture where a leader can say something and everyone has to follow along, then the necessary role of individuation doesn't begin to occur. Instead, it's this communal role that continues to go down a wrong path, at least let's say in terms of nuclear thinking. Not necessarily a wrong path in everything, but sometimes some of the issues that have to be addressed in a society, in a culture, need to be addressed from an individuation standpoint more so than a communal standpoint.
In Japan, with all the pressure for people to remain in a communal situation, since Fukushima Daiichi, there have been some truly egregious stances taken by the government. For example, they lied about the fact that 3 meltdowns had taken place. For months, they withheld that information. The Japanese government and TEPCO were not forthcoming about the radiation levels and dangers, not only for their own people, but to the United States government. And the USS Ronald Reagan, which went to Japan on a humanitarian mission, putting all the seamen aboard in harm's way. They will not allow people who are suffering the negative health impact of radiation exposure to even mention radiation as a possible cause when they go to see the doctor. And if anyone does mention radiation, they're made fun of and told that if they smile, they won't have any negative effects or suffering. So there's a huge disconnect between the communal following of leaders and the individual experience of many people in Japan. And that is starting to move them into activism. Is this a pattern you have seen happen in organizations where the personal disconnect from the leaders starts moving people into an activist response? And if so, how do you see that play out?
Incongruence competition, which means I do not have equal power, so I create an organizational system that can challenge you with a sense of power. In America, that would have been the unions. Challenging corporations around employee rights and things of that nature. In other places, rather than it being something as formalized as a union, it may be something such as a coalition of persons who pull together to fight against a particular issue. So there may be groups of Japanese persons who have banded together in a coalition of effort to say something about radiation, say something about poor decision making, say something about choices that harm the community, say something about choices that would impact children for a long time. But that's one way of looking at it. The underpinning component of that can be a form of PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. And what that means is that individuals experience a loss of 3 things: a loss of safety, a loss of security, and a loss of trust. When that gets built up over a long period of time without getting addressed, as you're describing, a patient goes to the doctor and the doctor says, smile and everything will be okay, persons begin to dissociate. And dissociation suggests that they will come up with a different persona, a different face, a different image to try and make themselves more acceptable to others even though they're in enormous pain underneath.
So once they're in disconnect from themselves, they might be moving into a personality that would be more challenging to authority than they would normally be. Do they usually go to the more passive state, or does it trigger people into activism?
It could trigger people into an activist stance. But the activist stance would be more from a communal perspective than from a personal perspective. So they're trying to do it according to the cultural norms that they're used to, rather than doing it from where they themselves personally are. Because that's not something they talk about. They don't talk about where they personally are. They talk about where we are rather than where I am.
So once they're in disconnect from themselves, they might be moving into a personality that would be more challenging to authority than they would normally be. Do they usually go to the more passive state, or does it trigger people into activism?
Potentially, yes. I couldn't say that unless I was actually there and could actually meet with persons to see that, but potentially, yes. Persons live by different schemas that they've created about their life. And the schemas are about who I am, how I relate to my world, how my world relates to me, and it gives a sense of how I'm going to walk my path down this world. So let's say you are Japanese, and you have created a schema that all is right, government will always tell me the truth, family is more important than individual, so forth and so on. You have a schema that you created that says communalism is more important than individuation. That's the first schema. Now, as you walk through that process, if you begin to have hits against your schema, okay, finding out the government is lying, having challenges around the decision-making for a nuclear power plant being built, family telling you, shut up, be quiet, listen, and just do what everybody else is doing. All of a sudden, you're beginning to wonder whether or not your schema was real, whether or not your schema was a good schema, and you begin to sense that those challenges are there. So you begin to try and individuate. And as you begin to try and individuate, what the culture and everybody says to you is you're not worthy to individuate. You have to stay within the communal system. Okay? So you begin to become anxious, depressed, isolated, feeling invisible, feeling hidden, feeling trapped. And those emotions take a much greater hold of you than the normal stoic face that you would normally have. So even if you try and present a stoic face, underneath all this trauma is beginning to occur. And that's that process of dissociation. I present my stoic face, but underneath I'm in a lot of pain, I'm in a lot of turmoil, I'm in a lot of trauma, and I don't know how to help myself move. Okay? Now, the reason I said organizational psychosis is because the exact same thing that I've just described to you about an individual also occurs within the organization. An organization has made a decision. It wasn't a good one. But they can't go back because they would lose face and say, I've made a bad decision, we should not be doing this, or we should do this differently. So they continue down this irrational spiral around the nature of the choices and the decisions that they make. Now, technologically, scientifically, throughout the world, we do things and implement things before we know everything about what we're doing. So sometimes we do things without knowing what the consequences are beforehand. Or we do things and either our information or the psychotic components of the organization cause us to demystify, devalue, disavow any real challenge with what we have done. So the government doesn't tell you about all the nuclear accidents or nuclear incidents that have occurred because they want to say they don't matter. Or they tell you that the radiation levels could never be large enough to really do you any harm. Or they tell you the foods and everything that we grow are protected from the radiation. Or they tell you doctors will help you, and at the same time they say to doctors, this is something you cannot talk about. All of those things are forms of the irrational structures being created around power control, disempowerment, and dysfunction. That's the nature of the organizational psychosis. Okay? So, organizational psychosis ultimately becomes the manner in which we impair our interpersonal and organizational functioning and relationship to the internal and external world. And we block our potential, our ability to get things accomplished. So we create unsupported choices, ineffective decisions, personal discounting, and it becomes the direction and the way of the company or the country or whomever around a particular issue. So to try and say to a country or a government, you made decisions without real support, you made decisions that were ineffective, you made decisions that harmed us personally, even though you didn't think they were doing anything negatively to the business. All of those things are forms of the organizational psychosis that begins to occur. And breaking that process requires persons to look at things very, very differently through using differing types of lenses.
That was where I wanted to move next. Because in this discussion of organizational psychosis, you've not only described Japan and TEPCO, but also the Nuclear Regulatory Commission here in the U.S., the San Onofre operators, Southern California Edison, and really the rest of the nuclear industry. We've seen these behaviors up close. So if you were called in to promote a turn to organizational sanity or organizational congruence, let's keep taking Japan as the example, where would you start and what steps would need to be taken?
Well, the first thing would be to ask them, do they really know what the issues are that are impacting them?
And the them that you're talking about, is this the government, the population, which is it?
I could do it with all of them, okay? I could do it with all of them separately, collectively. But the issue is there's seven things they need to do. And the first is they must look at, do they have true clarity around what the issues are and what the dynamics are? And that means that part of the clarity dynamic is understanding what's happening for people, understanding what's happening for systems, understanding what's happening for cultures, understanding what's happening for communities. If you do not go about getting all of that information up front, you never have clarity around the issues. Therefore, you can never make a sound decision about a strategy. So the first thing is to recognize you have to get clarity, and you have to get that from communal perspective as well as an individuation perspective. Secondly, you have to collaborate. Now, collaborating means you have to collaborate without power. It means you have to give up your power in order to be able to collaborate with someone else to hear what are possible outcomes, what are possible strategies. If you assume that because you had the MBA, because you're the CEO of a corporation, because you were this, you've been there a long time, that you know best, you cannot collaborate. Collaboration requires that I let go of, I surrender my power to experience what others have to say about the issue so that we can come up with a reasonable strategy. Third thing is what I would call compliments. There are always anchors within what has been done that you don't want to throw away. So the third thing is to recognize I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Instead, I want to try and understand what are the anchors that have mattered, that have worked well for our culture, our society, our organizations, that I want to keep, while at the same time I look at how to be different. The fourth is what I call creativity. Now, by that I mean we have been taught in business schools since 1980 that we should innovate, 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 innovate. Well, innovation means reworking the dead. You innovate because something stopped working. It died. So you're innovating it. Well, if this is going to work, you can't innovate. You can't take what has gone on with the budget and add 10% and assume that's going to work. Instead, you've got to be creative. So that means you have to not pay attention to what the dead was, but instead look at what really will resolve the issues for all the persons impacted. Remember, in organizational psychosis, it's about power, control, and authority through irrational choice. So in order to create, you have to be willing to give up the power, control, and authority to be able to see what options and possibilities really do exist. If you're able to do those first four, clarity, collaboration, compliments, and creativity, then you are able to make a choice. And the choice is a creative choice. From that choice, you then must look at what are the multiple levels, if we make this choice, that are either happening or not happening, and how do we close that gap? Okay? And only by doing that can you get to a place of congruence. So, my first perspective would be that those first four steps have never taken place around nuclear power.
I think that would be accurate.
No, they've never taken place around nuclear power, nuclear reactors, nuclear infusion into a community, because the decision-making process, the thinking process, the acting process has been compartmentalized rather than congruent. So it's almost as though they went through a Cartesian perspective that said, if I tweak this component over here, everything else will get fixed. And in reality, that doesn't occur. Okay? So, effectually, what we've created globally is ineffective organizations, organizational incongruence, and substantive organizational psychosis. And we push away anyone who might say something about that, like me, or like the coalition groups in Japan, who might say, stop, can we at least dialogue about what exists? Can we at least dialogue and speak truth about what is happening rather than continually trying to save face? How do we make a real difference that works effectively for the entire population rather than the government and the organization?
It sounds like something that needs to come from a willingness within government or the organization. And, of course, the situation that we are facing is that neither the Japanese government nor TEPCO, will leave the U.S. out of it for now, but that neither one of them seems open to this kind of a course correction. What advice would you give to the anti-nuclear movement, to those who are wanting more congruence and sanity on this issue? What kind of steps could we take from the outside to try and create that change within the dysfunctional government and corporate organizations?
Create that by sharing with people what is the level of organizational incongruence, what is the level of organizational psychosis, and how has it shaped and shifted and changed the country and the culture.
So you're talking about the equivalent of consciousness raising, people reaching out to each other and talking to build consensus.
Consciousness raising and action raising as well, because just raising someone's consciousness does not mean that they will therefore take action to empower themselves around that consciousness. So you have to do both at the same time. That's one. The second piece is it doesn't have to come just from the government or from the company that has created the nuclear power. It can come from everyone else who can speak to what are the challenges. When you think about organizational psychosis, there's some other components. Some of the other components are content of thought. When the thoughts that you're using in your actions by the government or by the company perpetuate implausible outcomes and a sense of persecution and paranoia, that blocks the ability of people to really have a clear sense of what's going on. So that's sort of like content of thought. If the forms of thought are about creating fear and creating myopia, and creating only one way of looking at things, and the forms of thought are fighting the loosening of traditional strong associations within an organization. One of the challenges is, in all of those things, content of thought, form of thought, perception, is it's about thinking. It is not about affect and feeling. And change only occurs when the affect is initialized.
Tell us a little bit more about what that means.
You can't create change within a society or within yourself if there's not an accessing of your emotions, your feelings that are driving what is impacting you, what's harming you. So if your affect is flat, listless, lethargic, protective, psychosis is set in the organization and the person. If the person, however, can access their affect and say, I feel this, I desire this, I hurt here, I enjoy this here, I do that, whatever, then they're beginning to become alive in their process. Flat affect leads to depression, despondency, and listlessness on the job. And in this case, it's created depression, despondency, and listlessness within the society and the culture. Because everybody say, I feel this, why can't you hear me? I feel this, why don't you touch me? I feel this, why don't? And the response ultimately is, smile. The response ultimately is, stand quietly in line as we have always done. The response is never, I hear you, what can I do to help you? That's not the response you get. So, the sense of self gets attacked. The ability to sense yourself as unique, capable, competent, responsive, has been replaced by a belief that you are incompetent, unable to perform, analytical, and usually function without direction. So the sense of self-direction, self-empowerment, belief in self gets knocked away. So there becomes no volition. There is a disturbance in self-initiation. There's a disturbance in goal-directed activity. There's a disturbance in role functioning. And people don't know who they are any longer. And the disconnect creates massive dissociation.
So it sounds like one of the key aspects of turning this around by the activist community and to help support the growing protest in Japan is that we need to access those emotions with honesty and clarity and make the emotional response visible to others. Would that be accurate?
That would be accurate. But here's how I would try and help persons to hear that. To be whole systemically within an organization, communally within your community and culture, individually, is you have to pay attention to four capitals. Those four capitals are human capital, community capital, resource capital, and political capital. Human capital is about the people. What's going on within the people, for the people, and how are the people being empowered to help themselves be all they can be. Community capital is about the community and the culture. To what extent are the values, beliefs, norms that we've lived by that have helped us grow and be who we are being sustained by the actions that we're taking. Resource capital is about money, equipment, and power. And political capital is about political influence and your ability to impact and get things accomplished by going around the system. Now, since the time of Ronald Reagan and his defeat of the Air Traffic Controllers Union and so forth and so on, we have moved from a focus on the four capitals to a focus on the two capitals.
Meaning politics and resources?
Resource and political capital, and we've forgotten about human and community capital for almost 35 years. Now, what does that mean? It means that all the actions of business, all the actions of government, have focused on two of four capitals. They haven't focused on the total system. So we have consistently, since that time, made our globe a psychotic globe, our organizations a psychotic organizations, everything, because if you're only focusing on the two and not including the four, then every decision you make disavows the human and community capital. Every decision you make is only focused on the resource and political capitals.
That is so accurate. It's a description, certainly, of what's happening here in the United States with the nuclear issue, and it explains Japan.
And all I'm saying is the healing space, the healing process, is about the reinvigorating of the four capitals. It's about using my seven C's to understand how to get things accomplished, and it's about paying attention to where systemic processes have really not been systemic, but have instead been compartmentalized strategies to create a certain outcome. And so change is based on trying to understand that. And so I have a process by which I teach people how to do that, how to get through that level of psychosis to ostensible organizational wellness, how to get individuals from that process of psychosis to a sense of wellness, how to help individuals look at the schemas that are taking them downward and how to instead build different schemas that can cause them to see their worlds differently.
If people want to learn more about your work, where can they go?
They can go to www.ittl.org, which is the Institute for Transformative Thought and Learning. If they have specific questions they want to ask, they can ask me by emailing me at orgdoctor@ittl.org. Or they can call me if they really want to discuss it at 602-300-1180.
This has been a fascinating conversation because you actually have a schema that explains where good governments and other organizations go bad, where maybe they weren't good to begin with, but they were better than they are now, so that by understanding the structure that you put forth and where the problems have been perpetuated, we have a chance to institute change. If you have a final thought or suggestion to leave with those of us who are working for nuclear sanity in the world, what would that be?
One, go slow to go fast, meaning really assure that you have all the information that you need, that you've walked the path of trying to connect all the dots between people, systems, and culture and community, and then create a plan of action. That would be go slow to go fast. Two, recognize that congruence is the underpinning base of what you're trying to get to, so that what you feel, what you think, and what you do match and are aligned. And three, learn to trust yourself. If you can trust yourself, you can make movement.
That was Dr. Lloyd C. Williams. Normally, the links to his website, email, and even phone number would all be posted on the Nuclear Hot Seat website. But with the hack, the best place to find him is on Facebook. You can search under his name, Dr. Lloyd C. Williams, or the Institute for Transformational Thought and Learning. And when the website is back up and functional, the links will be there. Now it's time for some more practical information on what to do online to get our message out there with Dave Parrish of Operation Save the Earth. Every week, Dave provides a social media tip for activists. And here he is in our Nuclear Hot Seat exclusive social media super tricks number 4, Twitter.
Hey guys, it's Dave from Operation Save the Earth, and I'm back again this week with part 4 of our social media super trick series. Last time we talked about whether to Facebook or not to Facebook and what the numbers showed. This time we'll do the same with Twitter. When Twitter began back in 2006, I remember the doubters, saying that a social media site that only allows 140 characters a post would never catch on. What they didn't realize was that Twitter was pitching to a different audience right from the jump, the smartphone market. And now, not even a decade later, Twitter has grown year to year to engage over 300 million active users monthly into posting over 500 million tweets per day all around the world. You see, Twitter has grown into more than just a playground for trendy celebrities. It quickly became a top news aggregator, one that even the mainstream media had to pay attention to as story after story began to break on Twitter first and then get filtered down. The immediacy of Twitter, because it was mobile-friendly right off the bat, has positioned it to not only just be popular and influential, but profitable over time as well. Like Facebook, Twitter became a publicly traded company in 2013. But unlike Facebook, Twitter is still focused on growing its platform organically by introducing the power of hashtags, trending topics, and live tweeting. It's no wonder that 80% of world leaders have a Twitter account. The versatility of what you can post, like videos and pics, also adds to Twitter's plus column But the best part of this social media is how connectable it is. And that brings us to our super trick of the week. You can plug just about any social media site you're already on, whether it's Facebook, Google+, Pinterest, Instagram, or what have you, which means you can use Twitter like I do, as a catch-all for all the important posts you want to put out about the cause. And here's why this is a big deal for us. Remember how I said last week Facebook is moving towards the Twitter model of trending topics? What better place to make hashtag Fukushima into a bigger deal all day, every day than the place that invented now trending worldwide? With Twitter, you don't have to log in and update it with unique content all the time. You just have to plug it into what you've already got. But be mindful that the meat of what you want to say needs to be in the first 90 of those 140 characters. So if you sign up for Twitter and start doing that, I think you'll find your own message will become sharper. And who knows? Maybe one of those world leaders who has a Twitter account will start taking notice of what we have trending. That's your super trick for the week. We'll see you next time.
That was the ever-ebullient Dave Parrish of Operation Save the Earth. Dave hosts Fuku Friday Happy Hour Hangout every Friday. Try saying that 5 times real fast. Every Friday at 4:30 Eastern, 1:30 Pacific Time on Google+. And with any luck in one of the upcoming social media's super tricks, he's going to explain Google+ to us as well. Activist shout out. Cindy Folkers and Beyond Nuclear has started a petition to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to protect children from radiation exposure and dump the propagandistic proposal from the whore-usis pro-nuclear shills trying to convince everyone that radiation is good for you. And they actually have the NRC considering this as well. What are those people thinking? What have those boys been drinking? The petition is up at change.org/P like Peter/United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and at that point you're probably going to get there. Just put little dashes between United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Please sign as soon as possible. They are aiming for 1,000 signatures, and in less than 24 hours are already halfway there. We cannot let the hormesis, that's what they call themselves, I'm the one who calls them whoreuses, but we can't let these people become the standard for evaluating the dangers of radiation exposure. So let your voice be heard now. Here's today's final thought. There was a terrific burst of nuclear information in the media last week to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the U.S. dropping the atom bomb first on Hiroshima, then on Nagasaki. The coverage was respectful, solemn, and some of it deeply moving, especially that which came out of Japan and focused on those who had survived the blast. But the majority of this coverage focused on the past, as though we no longer had nuclear worries in our lives. Only rarely was Fukushima brought up in connection with any of these stories. No, the meltdown of 3 nuclear reactors and more than 4 years of leaking radiation into the air, into the water, and poisoning the entire environment is really not as spectacular an event as the explosion of an A-bomb and the almost instantaneous combined total deaths of 135,000 in both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But the slow-motion radiation poisoning of land, water, people, children, fetuses, DNA, transgenerational DNA. That connection never got made in any but the most cutting edge of online sources. No mainstream media reporter or media outlet seemed to get the message that the bad guy in all of this is radiation and the damage it does. And whether it happens in a flash or over 30 or more years of slow leakage, radiation brings disease, damage, and death to life in all its many forms. 3 sites taken together can help explain to anyone what nuclear weapons are all about. I would suggest them in this order. The first is John Hersey's Hiroshima, which was reprinted in its entirety for free on the New Yorker website. Search there for the date, August 31, 1946, or you can just Google it and it will come up. Hersey's article is a highly detailed, moment-by-moment account of six people who lived through the atomic bomb blast at Hiroshima. Harrowing in its details, its humanity, and its immediacy, it shows that a nuclear explosion is not a surgical strike, but a lasting, ever-expanding plague on all those who experience it. Alex Wallerstein's Nuke Map is an interactive site where, by putting in the name of your city, choosing the size of a bomb blast, and clicking on boxes to compute casualties and fallout, you can see what an exploding nuke would do in your own very neighborhood. I always think it's good to start this process with the drop-down menu that includes all the named explosions that have happened, including Hiroshima. That's where I would start. But don't forget to try Tsar Bomba, the largest nuke explosion of all time, which happened courtesy of the Russians. This is a real good argument for the Iran nuclear deal. In order to find it, sorry, can't put the link up on the website right now, but you can Google Nuke Map, N-U-K-E-M-A-P with no spaces, and you will find it. Finally, ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, helped to produce a beautiful little animated film called The Nuclear Age in Six Movements. Poignant and uplifting, as well as extremely accurate in what it communicates, it can be viewed as both an educational resource and a work of art. The film is dedicated to all Hibakusha everywhere, Hibakusha being those who were exposed to the nuclear blasts at either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. You can find the film, The Nuclear Age in Six Movements. It's only about 7 or 8 minutes long. You can find it by Googling ICAN, I-C-A-N, with no spaces, and then after a comma, put in nuclear film. It will come up. And again, my apologies for no links up on the website, but we're going to fix that hack as soon as is humanly possible. In closing, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 11, 2015. Material for this week's program has been researched and compiled from ENENews.com, MiningAwareness.com, PowerForThePeopleVA.com, BBC.com, NOAA, CBS, AP, UC Santa Cruz, Discover Magazine, Weather Channel, KBBI, Alaska Raptor Center, Alaska Dispatch News, Eureka Times, Washington Post, Spokesman Review, Seattle Times, Special Correspondent Stephen Von Wagoner, TheWatchers.Adorelli.com, NJ.com, Counterpunch.org, LATimes.com, GlobalResearch.ca, TheWrongBlogWith2Gs.wordpress.com, MacombDaily.com, CommonDreams.org, RT.com, Reuters, Gordon Edwards, MiamiHerald.com, The Brain Eaten Zombies Who Write for the WorldNuclearNews.com, and the Faster Than a Speeding Tweet Superheroes of the Nuclear Hot Seat Community on Facebook, which you are all invited to join. Theme music written by me, sung by Marilee Weber, accompanied by John Barnard. Nuclear Hot Seat is syndicated by UCY.TV and is also available on iTunes under podcasts. Our archive is available on the website as soon as we get that fixed, but for now you can find it on iTunes or on YouTube under Nuclear Hot Seat videos, thanks to the dedication of Joni Ray. Nuclear Hot Seat is the activist voice on nuclear issues, so if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com once that is fixed, and until then, you can send it to libby@libbyhalevi.com. We are copyright 2015, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications, all rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that John Stewart has left the building and I'm still in mourning, but I'll get over it because he wasn't that good on nuclear issues anyway. and we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat.